Photography in one form or another exerts a great influence on our daily lives. An illustrative photographer must be imaginative.
Metaphor actually exists in the world. Photography has more of a claim to actually being able to produce that kind of function than virtually anything else. It seems like there's no author, if done correctly.
I'm Jordan Weitzman, and you're listening to Magic Hour, my chance to talk with photographers and people involved in the medium. We learn about their backgrounds, thought processes, and ideas that have shaped their work. Today I have the honor and pleasure of sitting down with John Gossage, a legend in the world of photography. John has worked in many capacities as a photographer, and has exhibited widely, first showing with Leo Castelli in 1975. The heart of his practice, though, has lied in bookmaking, which he has always considered to be the major leagues of the medium. In 1986, he published The Pond with Aperture, which went on to become a cult classic. We had this conversation at his apartment in Washington, D.C. The space is filled with photo books on bookshelves that line almost every wall in the apartment. On one of the only free walls, he has several prints hanging, salon style, by photographers that he's either known or have influenced him. One of which is a portrait of Eugene Ache, taken by Bernice Abbott. With the utmost sense of humility and playfulness, he said that whenever he catches a glimpse of that portrait, he sees his hero as someone like an old Jewish uncle looking over him, both inspiring him and telling him how much work he still got to do.
I had my first professional assignment when I was 14, shooting sports for the local newspaper, the Staten Island Advance. So, I mean, I had a history. By the way, my school history, they showed me my permanent record once, and I started virtually in the third grade missing dates of school. I didn't go to school. By about the seventh grade, I was absent more than I was present.
You didn't like school?
No, I have a learning disability, a form of dyslexia is a general, very, very general term, but it's not reading kind of thing. I don't write. So whenever I needed to write a paper or something, it was less embarrassing not to be there. So, and my mother was off working, and, you know, basically I was raised by wolves. Mm-hmm. So I would just, I would miss the school bus a lot and take the ferry over to Manhattan and start in, you know, South Ferry and walk up to the top of Central Park. That was a good day.
You just walk. You just skip school and do whatever. You do whatever a kid would do.
Well, I'd go to the Times Square record shop. Which was a great, it was in the subway at Times Square, and it had all the doo-wop records and a raccoon, pet raccoon. But the truant officers started looking for kids there. They never look for them at the Museum of Modern Art. I learned that very quickly. I had a membership card by the time I was like 11 or something. I asked my parents for it. But I think the story hinges on how do you educate yourself if you want to make pictures. There's no schooling, really. I did initially the two schooling things of anything that was not technical. I'm sure you could learn tech. Lisette Modell's evening class at the New School of Social Research, which is one day, night a week. And then Alexei Brodovich's design workshop. And that was it. It was over. You know, like there was nothing, there was nowhere else to go.
What was Lisette Modell's class like? How did she teach?
Oh, she was wonderful. She was my friend for the rest of her life, you know, basically. She would guide people rather than teach them. I mean, something I learned when I taught is that it isn't teaching that you're doing. It's encouraging learning. The best people learn. They're not taught. One thing that really affected me, I always remember, this one guy had gone out and photographed sort of trees at night with sort of rain on them, the sort of glistening effect, one of those cheesy photo effects. Mm-hmm. And what that would be, and she always called people darling.
Darling.
Darling, mm-hmm. You know. If you want to photograph a tree, you don't photograph the effect on a tree, you photograph the tree itself. That changed everything for me. That all of a sudden, you know, it's not about these pretentious kind of photo effects. If you actually want to make a photo of something, it's because you want to make a photo of it. I mean, the same, and she was very nice too. I mean, I took it probably when I was about 14, and you had to be 18 to be in the class. And I was terrified, you know. I mean, most of the time I was terrified. But, you know, she came, my darling, you know, yeah, you don't seem to be 18. And I explained, you know, and I sort of, I'm this model, I'm, you know, this ancient Viennese aristocratic woman. I said, oh, I'm 14. And she said, oh, very good. I mean, it was that kind of, she valued the fact that I was so interested that I wanted to do that, and I did all the assignments. And I also, one of the things we talked about before we started this, about my love of Agés, and that I have an Agé. One of the first books I ever got was this Agé book, because I asked Lisette the 14-year-old question, Miss Modell, one, you know, who's the greatest photographer ever lived? You know, like, you know, this kind of thing, you know, like, there's got to be somebody that's at the top of the food chain. And she explained it didn't quite work that way. And but she, and why she was my perfect teacher, because she knew how to get me. But darling, there is someone. His name is Eugene Agé. But darling, you wouldn't understand him. So she had me. She knew she had me. So I immediately went down to Wahi Bookstore in Lexington Avenue, which was one of the co-publishers of this 1930 Agé book, the only book on Agé. I opened it up, and there's little brown pictures of Paris. It made no sense to a 14-year-old kid who wants to learn how to street shoot in New York. She was right. But it taught me later, like 4 years, whatever time later, when I opened it up and it was like a lightning bolt, that's what photo books did. Like that, this ability to have this material and then to return to it was so phenomenally important.
To be able to revisit the books.
Revisit, I mean, that's one, and in the books that I do, this is an aside and move out of history, but I always think of the fact that this is something that can't be a one-liner. I mean, they're too expensive for one. I mean, if you go through a photographic book that costs $50, and you've gone through it once and you've basically gotten everything out of it, you've been ripped off, basically. What do you do with the sucker then? You know, like it's not like, as we were talking about earlier, like literature. I don't tend to reread a lot of books. Probably count them on one or two hands in my whole life that I've reread. Photo books, there's a sense that somehow there's more there, or, you know, you need to return to it. I mean, I don't know how many times I've looked at the Agé book or the Americans or, you know, any of the classic books, and they still offer something.
Having an open-ended quality, something is a key factor to a good book.
And that's what I try to do with everything I've ever done, is not make it a one-liner, not make it, you know, easy to get and done.
Pictures and books.
Yeah, exactly. Well, picture, also, I mean, it's the other thing of art photography. A student asked me when I did the graduate program at Maryland, he had come from photojournalism, and he said, you know, Professor Gossett, it's great when you're a high school dropout and you get to be, you know, like Dr. Gossett and stuff like that. But, you know, what's the difference between the kind of pictures I've made for the magazines and newspapers and art photography? And I was like, I hate smart students. You know? I don't go away. But I did it basically on, I said, you know, come back, next class I'll figure out an answer for you. And I basically told him, let's just take it on a market value. If you... Like, this issue's the Agé that I have on the wall, which I've had for over 20 years. If you pay thousands of dollars for something and you're done with it after 6 months, you spent too much money on something. I mean, I've gotten 20 years of education, pleasure, inspiration from that picture. It's one of the greatest bargains I've ever made. That's what the difference is. And if you're making a news photograph, you want it to basically empty all of its information immediately on the front page of the Times. You want to get all of this that's going on in Aleppo, Syria, or wherever, and you want to get as much of that information and reinforcement that the words that are written are true, because you can see it happening. And you want to turn the page and not have to go back to it. Mm. So it's a different form in any case.
Do you think about what qualities a picture needs to have or have in order to create that desire to go back to it over and over?
When I'm making the pictures, I don't think. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you do, you're in trouble. The kind of pictures I make, at least. But I do have a sense that you can make your instincts more intelligent or less intelligent. So, yeah, I mean, I consider what is... I mean, and everyone, what is quality in pictures, in photography? What am I making? I make things that exist generally in two forms, as single images without context. They exist on walls of galleries, of museums, of people's homes, and photographs, possibly the same photographs, often they are, that exist in books where a context of book covers also, you know, it changes things somewhat. I mean, supposedly the admoneration of a contemporary artist is you make the work and then you set the context for which the work should be seen. Mm-hmm. Sort of base 101, you know, contemporary artist 101. But the book lets you do that a lot more than most of the museumology of things, where you basically are in the swim of whatever the medium thinks it is. Mm-hmm. Which is dubious at best. Let's put it that way. We exist in a very, very forgiving field.
Yeah,
let's say, to be kind. But so the thought process of is this, to make it in the most broad sense, is this a pursuit worth spending a lifetime at? If it is, what can I encompass in it? How can you be inspired by what the medium has done? Does it appear to offer opportunities? It obviously offers pitfalls too if you avoid the opportunity. I try to do that.
Mm-hmm.
As best I know how.
So what was the first work that you did get or that really inspired you?
The Americans. Robert's book looked like the world around me, or close to it. It wasn't that far away. And that sense of order, disorder, you know, it would seem, even though he was, it seemed very American to me, where I knew of Cartier-Bresson's work, but it seemed very European somehow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seemed to match my experience of the streets of New York and give me, you know, more reinforcement to go out and try to learn how to photograph on the streets of what people were doing.
Is that what you did?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the mode that you worked in, you know, then.
Street photographer, like a black and white.
Like a black and white, all black, I mean, color photography.
Yeah.
No one did color photography except those fashion guys. You know, yeah. I mean, color, for, you know, until Bill and Steven, color photography is, I think Evans called it a vulgar form. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and also, color was very, very hard to deal with. I mean, getting prints was just, you couldn't make them yourself. It was very unwieldy,
yeah,
form.
So Robert Frank, the Americans, Cartier-Bresson.
I got to go up and visit. I mean,
really?
Well, how I learned, I had this revelation. These people I was looking at in these photography annuals, which is where I sort of, popular photography had an annual in U.S. Camera, which had the best photos of the year. So obviously I'm trying to find the best, don't know how to make the best photos. And I had this sort of instantaneous, most of these guys are in the same city that I live in. I'll put my pictures under my arm and ask them how to get better. It was just sort of, you know, I had a lot of time. I wasn't going to school, you know, like... I went up to Magnum. Well, I didn't know Bresson didn't hang around Magnum all the time. I didn't know he lived in Paris. You know, I had the luck of the draw. I mean, one day I knew where Magnum's headquarters was. I went up, put a little 8x10 box of prints under my arm and went to the receptionist and said it. I'm sure I mispronounced his name too. I wanted to see Cartier-Bresson. She sort of looked at me and then did the thing that utterly ruined every pretense I had, because she called back. He says, Cartier, there's a child here to see you. It was over. You know, all puffed upness, whatever you can get as a young teenager, it was gone. I was a child. I was ready to slink out of there. And he sort of came and looked at me. There was a big white partition that I think said Magnum on it. He looked around and said, young man, what can I do for you? And I told him that I'd seen his pictures and I thought they were, you know, wonderful. And I wanted to know how to get from where I was to where he was. And he was incredibly generous. You don't kick puppies, but, you know, it was very, more than nice. He looked at my pictures, said, asked me how I shot too. And I needed more discipline. He showed me his contact sheets.
Really?
He said, you have to photograph something. When you see a scene, you have to work it. You know, it was like, I remember he said, either the first one is the one, or I take at most 7 pictures. Mm-hmm. I know where he came up with that number, it was probably whatever the contact sheet was. And he showed me how he worked the scene and tried to, if I haven't gotten in 7, it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did a secondary night. He said that it was time to get a sandwich, get some lunch, and I should come to lunch with him, a little coffee shop. But he brought his camera. And I'll always remember this. It was like how people wait on the street corner in New York for the light to change. He sort of moved in front of them and took like 2 or 3 pictures. And it was like he was a ghost. It was like no one noticed him. And the thing that worries you so much when you're young is that all this embarrassment of street shooting, that, people will notice you and it's an embarrassing thing to do. And I was always had to steel myself to get over that, to make the pic, try to sneak them. He didn't sneak them. He just did it so naturally. It was like a fluid movement. I mean, this has been described often about watching Bresson, but like I saw it. And I remember saying, I want to learn how to do that. And it was like, most 99% of the people were incredibly kind. Eugene Smith taught me how to print.
Really?
I wanted to buy a Leica from him.
Wow.
Because he had a Leica for sale, somebody told me. It was so beat up, I was afraid to buy it. And he needed money, obviously. Gene often, and he said, he looked at my little box of prints and said, he really didn't know how to print very well. So he taught me, he taught me his methodology. He said, you come by and pay $10 in an hour. And the hour would always last 4 or 5 hours. I'd hang around and, he'd show me what he was doing and we'd talk and people would come by and play music. And, it was just like this great initiation. I won the National Teenage Photography Contest from U.S. Camera 35, one of their magazines, with this print of these two kids lying on a rock, and they had 2 balloons above them that they had. So they're lying flat out, and the balloons are way up in the air, a long string. Gene made the print for me.
Really?
So I know how to print this. It had lots of black and then a little white and everything. And I won the contest. And they commented that I printed amazingly well. And I never told anybody. So this is it. I'm out. They're going to take the award away from me now.
Yeah. That's funny. How old was he at the time?
Gene?
Yeah.
They were all old. Mm-hmm. You're a kid. Lizette was ancient. Lizette, she obviously wasn't. She's probably younger than I am now.
Yeah.
But it's like everybody was, they were adults. I mean, I didn't have many kids that were my friends. My friends were mostly adults.
Mm-hmm.
One, because nobody hung around the same place. They were all going to school. I didn't go a lot.
There's a Diane Arbus quote that I love and I always think about in terms of making pictures and kind of going back to what we were talking about before about that that quality that certain pictures have that keep you looking. Mm. And it's the, a photograph is like a secret of a secret.
Yeah.
The more it tells you, the less you know.
Yeah.
I wonder if we could talk a bit about that, a bit about what that means to you.
I think she's being slightly coy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Diane was incredibly seductive in a very, in a profound way.
Mm-hmm.
She would play little games with things, even with herself about things. A very complicated, very interesting person. Photography functions in a very funny and distinct way. I mean, Louis Baltzer said it's a very narrow but deep medium. Is right. It doesn't really do a lot of things extremely well. The other mediums do better, cinema particularly, motion pictures, literature, paintings. But what it does exceedingly well, which is it sets forth a threshold that if you present interesting information, we're willing to cross regularly with the viewer of any image, in that we're willing to entertain that this world actually existed previous and elsewhere, mm-hmm. and enter that world at that one moment, that still moment. And stillness is a very, it's an attracting thing that we don't get to experience in everyday life. I think it's one of these things we wish we could, I mean, any of your memories, you can't bring back mm-hmm. that detailed still moment of every, I think most people cannot, possibly somebody can, but, you know, and this ability to have everything that's in front, behind, to the side, you know, everything in that frame. And then if you can figure out a way by adjusting that to display some kind of meaning that's communicatable, either in things or in people, that fashion, that particularly in Arbus's case, that particular expression that doesn't dissolve into any easy explanation. It's not a smile, it's not a frown, it's something else that implies complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imply that complexity, that possibility that actually metaphor actually exists in the world?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an interesting... The photography has more of a claim to actually being able to produce that kind of function than virtually anything else. It seems like there's no author, if done correctly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can be... You can use photography for virtually anything, but you a lot of what goes on denies its inherent strength. So the secret is it doesn't really give itself over to words very well. They're two conflicting systems,
mm-hmm.
so that they don't ever really, really mesh well. I mean, her statement, enigmaticness of her statement is very, very similar to the enigmaticness of the photograph that she's describing.
Right.
It's functioning for you exactly like a photograph. It's something that's repeatable, and it's still not fully understood.
Right.
You keep going back to that statement, you know, a photograph is a secret, like, you know. And it seems perfect, it seems true, and it's not quite definable. That's the strength that photographs pull off. You can pull it off every possible way, from the way Jeff Wall does, who's one of my most admired artists, which you know it's not true. But it doesn't matter because the fiction has been so authentically presented.
Do you have any cues that you respond to? It's interesting. When you go to make pictures, often you respond to things that you've already seen as pictures. And that's maybe why you're responding to them. How do you get past that regurgitation of work that's come before?
It's a function of maturity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the fact that the pictures come quick and that I've seen them all.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, witness the books that you're surrounded by.
Will you ever take a picture that you think you've already seen?
No.
You won't?
Because it's not, I make them for my own education.
Right.
If I know that, I don't need to know it again.
Making something fresh or new.
Or attempting.
Is what excites you.
You know, I mean, you know, and mostly I'm making pictures that fail.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's what we all do.
A lot of failure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. You know, like it doesn't, you know, if you go, I mean, the project I've been working on for the last few years is possibly, I don't know, the last black and white film project around America. And, you know, I'll shoot 10 exposure rolls with this camera that I use. And, you know, if I get one picture that I print per roll, you know, I'm doing really well.
Right.
You know, so it basically... 9 reinforcements of clumsiness,
mm-hmm.
mistakenness, and stupidity. You know, like, it's really life-affirming to go out and make pictures.
Yeah.
You know, but that one supersedes that, obviously. You forget about the mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the mistakes are based on, this seems pretentious. This seems overwrought. That was why my friend Tim Carpenter sort of convinced me into doing a book of failures. I thought it might be interesting.
Your most recent book.
Yeah, yeah, which came from a conversation at a party with Tim where I just had gotten the idea of failures in my head. I never had an idea I was going to do a book of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were having this conversation over wine and such, and, you know, I was like, oh, well, you know, failures are interesting in photography. And
so the
then he sent me an email to me. He said, you know, when's the book going to be ready? You want to publish it? And I said, what book? The failures book. We want to do it. We're all scheduled. Oh, crap.
Is that how it happened?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah? That's exactly how it happened. And then actually it was one of the most interesting edits I've ever done. It taught me a great, great deal because, as we've talked about, I didn't want the book to be a one. It was the easiest one-liner book.
But they're all good pictures.
I can't use them.
You can't use them. Why?
It's not something that functions in my belief system. It's things that seem to fail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the interesting part. It's not, I mean, failures in this case are not mistakes. I mean, that's the easiest part. Oh, you know, you screwed up, you overexposed it, you missed it, you shook the camera. That's like nonsense. That's the worst one-liner. So could I make pictures that someone might be able to use, but I can't? So it was the ultimate audience book. It was like offering up something. Maybe you can use this even though I can't. It seems overstated or understated, or it seems to be a whole prelude to something that I don't deliver on.
Mm-hmm.
Or it seems all artificial.
We were talking before about Robert Frank and the Americans seeing that work, and Cartier-Bresson and that type of work, doing, you know, street work, functioning as a street photographer. But I've never seen any of that work.
Mm.
And it seems that the work that you went on to do was more akin to Ache or Evans. Mm. I guess a bit more of a documentary style or objective kind of quality to it. Does that
broadly? I mean,
right.
These people understood what the photographic potentials were,
mm-hmm.
and also as I'm doing it, coming up younger, street shooting is pretty much getting worn out. Mm-hmm. There seem to be, you know, there's no opportunity here, at least that I could figure out. I mean, someone will figure it out or has figured it out.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of players, you know, Friedlander and Winogrand sort of came up and sort of ended it, you know, in two particularly different ways. And it didn't seem that there was, you know, further to go with that. Also, I moved out of New York. Mm-hmm. I came down here to Washington, where there's a lot less to shoot on the street. It may just be that simple. It's not intellectual at all. It's just I lost my subject.
Yeah.
You have to understand one thing, always understand, when I'm starting this stuff, I'm very young.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, what the kind of, how do you try to figure stuff out when you're 15 or 16 or 17? There are lots of other issues, you know, like, you know, who's my girlfriend going to be is more important than what's my style going to be like?
Yeah.
A lot more.
Seems like you were thinking about those things too.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah. I don't know which one I was more successful at. Another issue, but in my case, as opposed to figuring it out and deciding what you're going to do, and I think this is actually more true for most, your style sort of finds you.
Mm-hmm.
If you pay attention to your successful pictures, if you're a good audience for your photographs tell you what you do well or what's being offered to you. And then you look for what the rest of the field and see if there's some degree of opportunity there. I mean, as I told you with Arbus, I photographed with my little square negative camera portraits of people because for a while, before realizing that there was the greatest portrait photographer of my time in my way. People would, you know, as she got known, people said, God, these are, you know, almost as good as, or as good as, if they were kind, that woman's pictures.
Yeah.
But it was always referenced with that. she won. I mean, I should have known from seeing the little box of 8x10s that she, and I instinctually did, that she had done everything that I had, might have aspired to do, and things that I never thought were possible.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's something you learn when you're young. You get out of the way, you know, because there's, you know, the crude metaphor, the 900-pound gorillas in the room. You know, you're not going to get around this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is an opportunity here.
Mm-hmm.
It's also what the world offers you. You right. know, you only know how to take pictures of a small, small segment of what the world has.
Mm.
It's like a sliver. And, you know, no one gets it all. Actually, I didn't get it all.
Do you still feel that same sense of excitement going out and making pictures?
Yeah, I mean possibility. Mm-hmm. It's like there's an opportunity now. Mm-hmm. I'm either on or off duty. I don't carry a camera all the time. I'm really happy to be off duty. Uh-huh. Things to be just what they seem to be.
You carry a camera only when you go out specifically to make pictures.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then it's like a different attention span.
Right.
I mean, especially the kind of pictures I make, which are of generally ordinary things. I mean, that's actually worth, you know, why. That's an intellectual decision, too, that that's where the greatest opportunity lies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's maddening. If I had to pay that kind of attention all the time, I'd never get anything done. I couldn't get my laundry done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's nice to be off duty.
Yeah.
But one of the things that guides me is that I think the greatest opportunity in making pictures of what can be made, of pictures that I've not seen made and I don't know where to find elsewhere, is in the most mundane and ordinary situations. I mean, to be able to go out and on a day, I mean, this is paraphrasing what Bob Adams has said, I'm sure much more eloquently, but to go out on a day and be able to make meaning out of ordinary life is a phenomenal gift. I mean, it really, that excitement is this opportunity to discover something meaningful in a day-to-day activity, roaming around Omaha, Nebraska, say.
Mm.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's a way to live a life, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, all the great events and everything, the pictures are always less than the event.
Mm-hmm.
My pictures are more than the event.
Yeah. There's a great richness to that.
That's interesting to me. That's life-affirming in a way that... I'm glad I have had the opportunity to do. I mean, and the fact that some other people get that is just icing on the cake. I mean, it's really, you know, like, I'd do it if nobody else got it but me.
Right.
Some days I feel that. especially when people write about it. They say, what?
When people write about your work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm very accepting of it, but it's like, huh?
Tim Carpenter's done a pretty good job, though.
Oh, no, I mean,
Tim's a great writer.
I mean, there's good stuff too.
Yeah,
you know, like Robert Adams reviewed The Pond.
Right.
You know, like Lewis Baltz's review. You know, like Gus Blaisdell. You know, like there have been people that have written. You know, gee, I didn't know I was smart until I read what Gus Blaisdell read. Why does someone that smart actually like what I do?
The Pond was your first book.
Actually, the second.
The second.
One of the conceptions I had, which I've sort of abandoned, but I wanted to do... I did a book called Gardens for Castelli, my gallery.
For Castelli?
Yeah, Leo Castelli Gallery.
So you were showing at Leo Castelli Gallery.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Lewis Baltz was the first photographer to show with Castelli.
Mm-hmm.
Became a friend of mine. And... we were all in a show in Baltimore called 14 American Photographers that Renato Zanesi, the director, curated, and I helped him somewhat on because of his scheduling. I helped select the pictures, but not the photographers. And Leo sort of used the catalog as a wish list. I won't remember all 14, but it was like Robert Adams, Bill Eggleston, Lewis Baltz, Lee Friedlander, you know, it was like the usual suspects in any case, you know, myself. And it was the moment in time when it seemed, when Leo, who was always very ambitious for all of his all of his gallery projects, noticed that he liked what Lewis did because it related more toward work like Donald Judd or such that was actually in the gallery, Flavin. But he wanted to do more, and he asked Lewis who he should do, and he asked my friend who I mentioned earlier, Walter Hopps, the curator, and they both said me. I was actually at the point here in Washington where I realized I probably had to move back to New York to make the contacts to get a gallery. Mm-hmm. And I had this amazing, I mean, graduate students hate me for this because they always want tactics and everything. And, I was sitting, in an apartment, and I got two letters, one from Eliana Sonnabend and one from Leo Castelli, asking me to be in the gallery. Uh-huh. And my dealer down here, Harry Lunn, had made contact and said that Light Gallery wanted to be in their gallery. So I realized I didn't have to move back to New York when I was quite young. Girlfriend of mine, who was older, bought me a Lichtenstein drawing from my 17th birthday from Leo. Uh-huh. And I'd always wanted to be in Leo's gallery. Like, this was the greatest gallery on earth, as far as I was concerned. And yeah. I went up and saw Leo and wound up being, shaking his hand.
What was he like?
It was always scary because he was Leo Castelli. He was like the greatest dealer on earth, and he was much older than you were, and he was incredibly gracious and suave, and you were sort of a little bit afraid of him. I mean, it wasn't his doing. It was just who he was and the fact that, he'd been there and, created so much art history and had the best eye and, in all of the world. So
yeah. So it was a big honor.
It was a big honor. I mean, I didn't need to do any more gallery stuff.
After that,
yeah,
that kept you going for a little while.
Well, about 15 years, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So your picture is sold?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, again, they weren't. I mean, Lewis Baltz and I had a drink on Madison Avenue once when we decided that finally our pictures cost more than the frames.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Leo didn't know how to do second rate. He did use a man named Jared Bark who did the best frames in New York, and the frames were more expensive than the prints.
How much were the prints going for at the time?
Oh, like $250 or, I mean, Leo, I remember Leo once coming in to me and said, "Oh, John, why is photography so inexpensive?" I mean, you understand, it took him the same time to sell a photograph for $200 or $500 as it took for him to sell a Jasper Johns painting.
Right.
I mean, it's like a waste of his time to sell this stuff. He should just give them away.
Yeah. I mean, still compared to the other arts, it still is a relatively inexpensive medium. I mean, it's obviously, we've come a long way, but it's,
Well, it's also a multiple in the main, and the art market prices are driven by the singularity of the objects. Right. I mean, just the simplest thing is two guys in a room, in an auction room, who are used to getting in their way and have deep pockets wanting the same object.
Right.
That's what drives the expense of anything, and the fact that even the suspicion that there might be another one derails that event,
mm-hmm.
that interaction.
How were you framing your pictures at the time? Were they simple black or white frames?
Things would be different. I mean, I did a show, these big black Stadt & Schwarz pictures that were 30 by 40 inch things, and they were framed like big things, and they leaned into the room slightly.
At the time?
Yeah.
At Leo Castelli?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was actually one of the nicest installations, and the nicest comment, Richard Serra liked the installation.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I took that as, it was like, plus. It was nice. I mean, it was nice. I mean, Leo was also incredibly great. I mean, when anyone was around, he would introduce you to everybody.
Right.
Rauschenberg and Johns. But my first show was with Jasper Johns.
Wow.
I mean, how do you beat that?
That's pretty incredible.
Jasper was around for a few days. He's a very, very nice, quiet man. And, all of his pictures were pre-sold at, I think, about, a couple million dollars each.
Wow.
And, he was upstairs and I was in the graphic space downstairs. And I suggested to Leo that we just change the wall label for mine. Just say John's pictures. we could charge a lot more for them. Jasper found that funny.
That's pretty good.
I mean, it made sense. I mean, it was a good marketing ploy.
So back then, you were thinking, you were thinking a lot about the context of the gallery and how your pictures would be presented. Were you thinking about that?
Well, I mean, books seemed... I mean, I remember Lewis Baltz and I, you know, sort of... He'd had New Industrial Parks out before I did The Pond, but we both sort of had this vision that this was our... This is like American Photographs. This was our one book. And then maybe when we got old, someone would do another one. I mean, I had a lot of publishing options. Either I could do it with Aperture, I could do it with Aperture, or I could do it with Aperture.
Right.
I mean, you know, like it just wasn't anybody else.
Yeah. And how about the idea of doing it on your own, just self-publishing it?
You know, I mean, that was sort of lame. And yeah, I mean, Lewis did that with Industrial Parks, and he basically gave away virtually all the copies. I mean, I don't think Lewis had a little bit more economic resources than I did. I couldn't afford to do it.
Yeah.
And then you had all these books under your bed. It was just... I mean, distribution is still the devil, but it was like there wasn't any mode for it whatsoever as self-publishing. You could do shows regularly.
Right.
And you thought about how work should be presented in exhibitions.
Uh-huh. Was that how you were earning a living at the time? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah.
But you were teaching as well?
Well, yeah. Well, teaching was sort of funny. I mean, I got asked to run the graduate program at University of Maryland, and I'm a high school dropout.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never been in a college classroom. I thought it was funny. And I said the great thing to the head of the department that I didn't have time because I really didn't to do faculty meetings or any other stuff, but I teach the classes. And he said, fine. Hmm. So I went in one day a week and taught a class to people I selected because it was graduate.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it a lot. I enjoyed the process. I enjoyed the interaction. It helped me form my own thinking to actually have to verbalize it, which I never had to do. I mean, you know, like Eggleston and I, you know, like when I was in Germany a lot in Berlin, they'd always think, well, what do you talk about? Yeah, well, Bill would say, well, that's a good one. Thank you, Bill. Yeah, I mean, nobody talked about the American, German photographers always talking about theory, whether it's objective or subjective. Michel Schmidt would just go batshit because I don't care.
Yeah. Good pictures or not good pictures.
Yeah, it was just like, that's a good one. Yeah, I like that. I mean, it was sort of implied.
Yeah. How about Eggleston? We were talking before about him, and you were going to tell me about how you met and how you guys became friends.
Bill Christenberry was a friend of Eggleston's from college days in Memphis, and he lived across the street from me. And he just said, I have this friend coming by, and he's in town, and you might want to see him. And Bill bought a whole bunch of black and white and color pictures. And I thought they were remarkable.
He always says, he always talks, I mean, I've heard him be quoted about the, you know, one picture of one thing. And I'm never able to believe it. Is it?
Oh, sure.
That's what it actually was.
Well, I do the same thing. I take one picture of stuff.
One picture?
Yeah. It's
move
like,
on.
Why do you need a second one? I mean, occasionally I'll worry about something being inexact or crooked or something. I'll take a second one, but...
Yeah,
I mean, it's just the methodology.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you need two? There'll be one extra then.
Yeah, harder to decide.
Yeah, no, I mean, to decide. To you already got one. Why do you need a second one? I mean, it's not like a difference.
When you started to work in color, digital color, did you work the same way?
Yeah.
Oh,
pretty much. I mean, digital is really easy because you can just delete the crap. Yeah, I mean, pretty much... I mean, one of the reasons I started, I always hated film color.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you have film, they have to engineer a color space in. Actually, Bill set me up. I did two dye transfers in the 70s with Bill's people just to see, and they look like weak Eggleston's. I mean, that's Bill's palette. It's not my, it's not what I see. And I could never make color pictures when there was film. It just, you know, like I didn't. I was married to Terry Weifmacher, who's one of the great master color printers. And, you know, I try it, and he said, no, you can't make that exposure, this crossover. And I just could not get them to look the way I needed them to look until digital got good.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like, I basically asked Martin Parr, you know, what kind of cameras do the Magnum guys do, and just bought a 5D and, you know, went out. And the first day I made one picture that wound up in the book, 32-inch rewind. If I can make that one... It looks right. Now I can make color pictures. And there's certain projects that really need color. And I can do that.
Did you start to print those yourself?
Yeah. Well, what I did is again, it's the same way I did when I was a kid. I hired a really good custom printer in St. Louis, where I actually had been doing a project and met him, and I had him do about, you know, a dozen or so pictures, and I bought a big Hewlett Packard printer and I printed on it until I could match his prints.
Hmm. There was a quote that I heard you say a little while ago, and I'm not sure if I might be paraphrasing a bit, but it goes something like, I have no idea what I'm doing anymore, and I'm absolutely sure of it.
Yeah.
At this point, I've developed a style, and I think that style is the sum of all my inadequacies. I know what I can't do.
Yeah. I mean, style can be looked at from the other side. It's just the sum of your inadequacies.
Right. You just got to keep on going. And
I mean, that implies that you actually do some things adequately.
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, it is a praise in a funny way.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I still have things that interest me. I mean, we were looking before. I have the pictures that I made last week in interim time when I had to go out and, you know, do some family business. But there was downtime when there was nothing to do. So I went off and photographed.
Mm.
And the pictures fascinate me again and surprise me and educate me and give me indications that there are more pictures to be made in a project that I thought I was totally over with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's now time to get, you know, do whatever editing I do and figure out what it's going to be. The fact that makes life interesting. I mean, somebody asked me, you know, well, what are you going to do when you retire? Retire? Well, I've never had a job. How do you retire? You never had a job. You know, but it never, you know, like I will stop making pictures when I physically can no longer make pictures.
Yeah.
That's it.
So what are you working on now?
The America Project.
The America Project.
Yeah.
What's that about?
America. What's George Washington's white horse's color? Yeah. You walked into that one. You go, fucking Canadians.
That was my conversation with John Gossage. This episode was produced by me, Jordan Weitzman, and was edited by Crystal Duhane. On-location sound engineering by Lenny Pierre Ramos. Music in this episode was by Poddington Bear, Damien Lazarus, Michelle Macklin, and the Monks. Join me next time when I sit down with Gregory Halpern to discuss his work and his new book, Zizix.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.